And good morning, it's KBOO, K-B-O-O Portland, your community radio station at 8:59 to be exact here on this Thursday morning. Coming up in an hour, Chris Andre takes the studio with hosting Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. Then at 10:15, we'll have Flashpoints. At 11 today, it's Between the Covers. We'll be speaking with Portland writer Robert Hill on the show today. And at 11:30, it'll be Words and Pictures. Conch will be in the building, and we'll be joining Oregon Historical Society director Carrie Timchuk for an audio preview of the Comic City USA exhibition. That and more coming up on the show. But first, we've got Teresa Mitchell hosting Press Watch with the news you're not supposed to know. Stick around, that's coming up next on KBOO.
Good people, it is official. Guess Who's Coming to Radio is now 3 hours. Every second and fourth Thursday from 7 to 10 p.m., we will continue to use the airwaves as a tool of positivity, awareness, and proactivity. We have a platform, and we intend to use it to encourage liberation. Many of us in the struggle for African liberation need a positive soundtrack, so music and words which feed the mind, body, and spirit are welcome here. Your support all these years have moved us to always strive to do better radio. And now you get one more hour. Again, stay tuned every second and fourth Thursday from 7 to 10 p.m. for Guess Who's Coming to Radio on KBOO, your community radio.
Hi, I'm John Schuck. We're starting an experiment at KBOO. We're going to pilot a new program called The Beloved Community. We'll address the philosophical and spiritual foundations for nonviolence, activism, political engagement, and peace building. We'll also hear voices who are building the beloved community right here in Portland. On this first show, I speak with New York Times bestselling author Marianne Williamson. We discuss her new book, Tears to Triumph, The Spiritual Path from Suffering to Enlightenment. Greenpeace activist and nonviolence advocate G. Scott Brown will talk about his book, Active Peace, A Mindful Path to a Nonviolent World. And I speak with Jenna Yokoyama, co-host of Pacific Underground, a program on KBOO that highlights the experience of Asian Pacific Islanders. We're building the beloved community this Friday, August 12th at 9 a.m. on 90.7 KBOO.
The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. I want to talk about climate change today. It's a topic that I usually put off to the bottom of my scripts, something that I want to keep going along on various shows. There are certain things that I like to touch on every week if I can, for example, Black Lives Matter. But climate change. I haven't gotten around to it, so this week I'm going to emphasize that. First, a few headlines, and before the headlines, a comment. And this comment is going to upset some people, but I want to assure you that I've thought about it long and hard before mentioning it. To frame it, I want to say that as a transgender person, I am occasionally confronted with violent people, and I don't want to make false equivalencies. I don't want to say that my experience is like that of a black person. It's not. There are a couple of parallels that I can point to, and one of them was an incident that occurred now 10 years ago, and which I have mentioned on the air often, in which I committed the crime of parking my car in a no-parking zone, and a couple of business owners came up and confronted me over it. It was none of their business. They are not in charge of enforcing parking on the street, and engaged me in a loud argument. It became clear that they intended to get their jollies by confronting me. And as I barked back at them, one of them mentioned that she had a gun. And so I could see that given the situation, and as it came out later, they were in fact confronting me, at least in part due to their hatred of transgender people. It could have come out that I would have been gunned down, and they would have had the story to tell. And I imagine their story would have been something like, "I feared for my life." And it wouldn't have mattered, and a tranny would be dead, and that would be that. But that's not how it came out. And this is where I get to the point. I want to add, you know, because I've experienced something slightly similar to the gun violence, I want to add this to the mix. There is such a thing as what is generally called, I mean, worldwide it's more frequently called, the Palestinian gun grab. I've referred to it previously as the Robinette gun grab. That's a trademark, and I think that person's out of business. But the Palestinian gun grab is a real thing. And because the situation is so dire and so many people are dying in point-blank confrontations, I would like to present that as something that can be done. And I will not give you details on it. I will just say that it is a real thing. It has saved many lives across the world over the years. I can think of an instance in which a Sandinista was saved by his knowledge of the pistol grab. And it's not something that you can learn on the web. It's something that you have to practice carefully. And in the process of practicing it, you will understand at some point that you have the skills to save your life under certain conditions. And it's a real thing, and it's what I had in mind when I closed distance with that couple, because I was afraid that they were about to pull a gun on me. And I was afraid that I would be killed, and that is the circumstances in which you will use it. When it is preferable to immediately dying, then you use the gun grab. And I know that police and police advocates are going to be upset with me for bringing this up. But, well, the situation is what it is, isn't it? And it's time to save lives. And it may be that you, and you would need an organization with you to practice with. It may be that you and your organization will need to practice the Palestinian gun grab, and that might need to be a thing. Okay, going to headlines. From Radio Havana, Bernie Sanders said that to many Brazilians and observers, the controversial impeachment process against Dilma Rousseff more closely resembles a coup d'etat. In a statement issued by the senator's office, he said that the United States must stand up for democracy in Brazil and demand that its political crisis be resolved with new elections. He added, quote, "I am deeply concerned by the current effort to remove Brazil's democratically elected president Dilma Rousseff," end quote. Sanders, the runner-up to Hillary Clinton in the race for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination, had harsh criticism of the Brazilian coup. That's from Radio Havana, Cuba, Radio HC.CU. Press the British flag to get the English translation if you need that. Also from RHC, the U.S. State Department has approved the potential sale of nearly 1.5 billion in munitions, including 130 Abrams battle tanks and 20 armored recovery vehicles and other equipment to Saudi Arabia. Following on the tone of what I was saying earlier, Abrams battle tanks are powered by a turbine, which has a tremendous need for rapid air intake. The air intake for the turbine on an Abrams battle tank is directly behind the turret. Think paper bags of concrete dust. Returning to the article, the announcement coincides with Saudi Arabia's military campaign in support of Yemeni forces loyal to the exiled government of President Rabu Mansur Hadi in their effort to house Houthi forces from the capital Sana'a. The high number of civilian casualties has led human rights groups to criticize airstrikes by the Saudi and Yemeni loyalists. The U.S. Defense Security Cooperation Agency, which oversees foreign arms sales, said that General Dynamics will be the principal contractor for the sale, adding it would contribute to U.S. national security by improving the security of a regional partner. Saudi Arabia and its mostly Gulf Arab allies intervened in Yemen's civil war in March 2015 after the Houthi movement had pushed the Hadi administration into exile in Saudi Arabia. On Tuesday, the Saudi-led military coalition conducted airstrikes in Sana'a for the first time in 5 months, according to residents, after the UN-backed peace talks to end the conflict broke down over the weekend. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch called on the United Nations General Assembly in June to suspend Saudi Arabia from the UN Human Rights Council until the military coalition stops killing civilians in Yemen. That was edited by Lena Valverde Jordi, and once again, that was from Radio Havana, Cuba. You can get it at 6,000 megahertz or 9820 in English in the evening, or radiohc.cu. 11 minutes after 9 o'clock here in Cascadia, and I would like to talk about the climate change disaster. And when I am speaking of the climate change disaster, it occurs to me that there is a common ideological frame for it that presupposes a globally simultaneous phenomenon. In other words, due to our ideas, perhaps coming from Christian ideation, we think that climate disaster means everything happens everywhere at once. This is not necessarily the case. And cannot be the case in the present moment. I'm not speaking of divinely driven apocalypse when I bring up climate disaster. I am instead speaking of exactly what we are experiencing, which is one storm after another, separated by time and place. One disease after another, separated by time and place. One crop failure after another. For you and I right now, the form of the disaster is that it is far more probable that we will experience some extreme event, some fire, insects, something, and this increased probability is being expressed around us in random ways. So the storm flooding in Ellicott, Maryland, which is horrific, is complemented by dozens of horrors around the globe, and in each locality, people tend to feel that their situation was a fluke. But the National Academy of Sciences stated otherwise this past March. They said the frequency and intensity of extreme events could now be attributed to climate change. And I presume they created metrics for that, but I don't have that level of detail for this program. So I want to talk about climate change, and so I will give you the number to call in with your comments and questions on that or anything I've brought up, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. From CNBC, the worst fears for our U.S. corn crop are being realized. And as the government now expects the lowest yield in 17 years on a total crop of a third smaller than what was projected at the growing season, this from Washington Post, crops are wilting in the fields in several states in the southeastern United States from an extreme drought that has crept up under the radar of most people living outside the region. Farmers in northern Georgia, northeast Alabama, southeast Tennessee, western North Carolina, and northwestern South Carolina are desperate for rain as harvest time nears. Combined with above-average heat this summer, the corn crop in numerous counties has already been wiped out. From April 1st to July 31st, Chattanooga, Tennessee had only received 61% of its normal rainfall, a deficit over 6.5 inches. August has started off dry in that city with a meager 0.09 of an inch in the first week. And throwing gas on the fire, the June and July average temperatures were roughly 4 degrees warmer than normal. Areas are in drought. Data from the most recent U.S. drought monitor show northern Georgia hardest hit with most counties under extreme drought conditions, while western North Carolina is just slightly better off with severe and moderate conditions. Tougher crops like cotton and soybeans are surviving. But according to Norman Edwards, an agricultural extension agent for Walker County, Georgia, cotton and soybeans are surviving, but the corn crop is gone, and so is most of the hay. Pastures are so barren that some cattle farmers are resorting to feeding their livestock baled hay instead of allowing them to graze off the parched land. That's according to the Maryville Times. Georgia's famed peanut crop has also been adversely affected. The peanuts that don't have irrigation are really kind of suffering from the drought. And that's according to Don Kohler, executive director of the Georgia Peanut Commission. He said they have not fully developed as plants. The region needs rain sustained over a long period to alleviate the drought. This week, as low pressure over the southeast draws tropical moisture northward from the Gulf of Mexico, some beneficial rains are likely. A little bit more to that article. You can find it in Washington Post. It's by John Hopewell. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Wildfires raging in Portugal killed at least four people, and more than 1,000 people were evacuated on the tourist destination island of Madeira, where flames spread to its regional capital, Funchal. That's according to authorities. Yesterday, the Portuguese Interior Ministry said it had requested help from the European Union. Spain sent two planes, and Italy sent one aircraft to help with the firefighting efforts. This abnormal situation, Prime Minister Antonio Costa said, surpasses the normal response capacity of our forces, and he warned that the next few days could be critical due to scorching temperatures. Lisbon also sent a force of more than 100 emergency service workers on a military plane to Madeira, where the fires, fanned by strong winds, have killed three people, destroyed about 40 homes and a five-star hotel in the hills above Funchal. On mainland Portugal, one person was killed by flames in the central Santarém region as thousands of firefighters struggled to control dozens of forest fires raging amid a summer heat wave across the country. And Reuters says the fires have destroyed homes, shut major motorways for hours, and forced the evacuation of several villages this week, mostly in the north of Portugal. They had an associated video with that, which is rather alarming to watch. One of the images was of cars seen from above, which had been parked by the hundreds in a parking lot, and they were all gutted down to their frames. That's fires extending to the cities on Madeira Island, just off Portugal. The fire in Funchal was mostly under control, Reuters writes, by late morning. But the regional governor said other blazes were still raging on the island today. He said 80 people were in hospital suffering from burns and smoke inhalations. All those killed and injured by the fires were local residents. More than 1,000 residents and tourists were sent to makeshift shelters and army barracks during the night, although some have been allowed to return since two hospitals in the area were also evacuated. And I have more on that fire from robertscribbler.com. Who writes extensively on climate change. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. He writes, over the past week, Sahara Desert-like weather conditions marched north into Spain and Portugal. The extreme abnormal heat brought with it a rash of severe wildfires, and unfortunately, these are exactly the kinds of conditions we should expect to see more and more as a result of human-forced climate change. He writes, yesterday the temperature hit a hot, dry 40 degrees Celsius, that's 104 Fahrenheit, just west of Lisbon. Temperature is more typical to the Sahara Desert, hundreds of miles to the south. On any normal August day, this Atlantic coastal town would expect to see readings around 83 degrees Fahrenheit. To the north, a sprawling heat dome of high pressure is tucked beneath a big jet stream wave for much of the past week, pulled poleward by near-record low sea ice extents. This atmospheric brute, one of a new breed made stronger and thicker by human-forced warming of the atmosphere, funneled in brisk winds even as it baked Portugal's lands and islands day after day. Now, departing from this article, this sort of extreme heat event and extreme storms are going to become more common, as I said, because of global warming. But I want to mention a couple of the mechanisms that cause that to happen. One is that the entire atmosphere has expanded. The entire atmosphere of the planet Earth has expanded to the point that satellites have had to be reorbited because they are simply getting too much air drag. To put a satellite in order in orbit efficiently and to use its transmission capabilities most efficiently, you want to put it in a pretty low orbit. And so you launch the thing at a speed and an angle that will put it into orbit. The speed is 17,500 miles per hour, approximately. And once you put it up, you want it to be outside the atmosphere altogether while that has changed. And so this tropospheric expansion means that there is more air to take in heat. There is a larger atmosphere. In addition, the fact that the entire atmosphere is warmer means that it can absorb more water. This means that storms become more extreme, and we can look to the Ellicott City flood as an example of that. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. The point that I'm making here is that the climate disaster is upon us. It's upon us and all of our imperial designs and all of our Jim Crow mass incarceration state and all of our good things are now subject to this ongoing disaster. What do you think about it? 503-231-8187. What do you want done? On mainland Portugal, Robert Scribbler writes, scores of fires cut roads and power lines. Whole villages were emptied as the blazes encroached. Numerous homes were destroyed and one life was tragically lost. Elsewhere, firefighters scrambled to get a toehold in containing multiple out-of-control fires with a massive mobilization that included more than 4,200 emergency personnel from across the country. This abnormally tough-to-control fire situation spurred Portuguese officials to seek aid from the European Union. The request drew a swift response from Spain as well as Italy, which immediately sent three fire suppression aircraft to aid in the massive effort. Southwest across the Pacific, the Portuguese island of Madeira, one of several islands in the Madeira archipelago, was also burning. Abnormally hot conditions over the past week, with 95-degree Fahrenheit temperatures and strong dry winds, had fanned large fires running across the island. By Tuesday, archipelago capital city Funchal saw numerous fires rushing towards town. Both firefighters and the military mobilized, but this combined effort was unable to prevent the fire from entering the town. Three people were tragically caught up in the blazes as 40 homes burned and a famous five-star hotel was consumed to its foundations. My question for you, what do you want done? Shall we shut down the fossil fuel industry? Should we demand a cessation to Contrail and Yak Hamtrail producing night flights? Although the only chemtrails I personally observed have been sprayed in the day. And I want to emphasize, as I always do, that there is a difference. And the only evidence that I have seen of chemical trails is a more rapid spread. I haven't done any chemical analysis, and I don't want to engage in speculation about chemical analysis that has not been performed. But contrails are affecting the weather very much. And there are commercial operations now that can be and have been hired by municipal and agrarian societies to control the weather. And this is happening. And so you can comment on that as you well as you wish. 503-231-8187. Do you want that to continue? Do you want to, I mean, that is geoengineering. Do you want that to continue? Do you think that there should be a sort of desperation tax on fossil fuels? What should be done? Because I would argue that something needs to be done immediately and drastically, and that at this point, with a rapidly increasing and self-aggrandizing, that's the wrong word, self-increasing, I'll think of that word in a minute, with the situation such that it is worsening itself, what needs to be done? What would you support politically, socially? 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Returning to the article from robertscribbler.com, like many regions of the world, Portugal experiences an annual fire season. However, this year's fires are far more extensive. They rage under hotter than normal temperatures, and they are being fanned by strong, dry winds. In short, 35 to 40 degrees centigrade readings, that's over 100 degrees, are not normal for any time of year in Portugal. The fire conditions, therefore, are far worse than what Portugal typically experiences. But in the New World, forced to warm by human greenhouse gas emissions, such conditions, along with a much more extreme wildfire potential, are far more likely to occur. Here, speaking for myself, here in Cascadia, we're not experiencing anything like that. So maybe it's hard to take this as an urgent situation. But that's the point I'm trying to make, that we are experiencing a worldwide climate disaster. We're just on the edges of something far worse, I do suspect. Though I can't know that. Absolutely can't know that. I would like to know what you think about it. 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Fires happen almost every summer in Portugal, Robert Scribler writes. Just not fires like these. It's obvious from Portugal's request for assistance that the large number and extreme intensity of the fires has saturated Portugal's emergency firefighting capability. Prime Minister António Costa, in a news conference earlier today, starkly stated, quote, "This abnormal situation surpasses the normal response capacity of our forces," end quote. It is worth noting that these fires have not yet reached the extent of the 2003 blazes. Back then, a massive European heat wave that many scientists have attributed to human-forced climate change helped to spark wildfires that killed 19 people and burned fully 10% of Portugal's forests. But it's clear the 2016 fires are already among the worst Portugal has ever experienced, and this fire event isn't yet finished. Over the coming week, temperatures are expected to range from 35 to 42 degrees centigrade again, and Fahrenheit, that ranges over 100 degrees, providing no hint of relief in an already dangerous fire situation. You can find that at robertscribler.com, which I recommend for your bookmarks if you're trying to keep up with climate change. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Now I want to turn to other aspects of the climate disaster. Food shortages brought on by extreme weather events have resulted in almost a quarter of Sri Lanka's 21 million people becoming malnourished. That's according to a World Food Program document. Quoting that document, a country brief for Sri Lanka released in June, the increased frequency of natural disasters such as drought and flash floods further compounds food and nutrition insecurity. As per the WFP's most recent cost of diet analysis, almost 6.8 million or 33% of Sri Lankans cannot afford the minimum cost of a nutritious diet. And a large portion of this vulnerable population lives in poverty and is frequently subjected to extreme weather events. Once again, speaking for myself and departing from this written script, this is the sort of thing that was predicted for many years in the future, just a few years past. Well, we are in the future now, so to speak. We're in that dystopian climate disaster future. And I have many, many, far too many to present in a one-hour program, many, many examples of that. But returning to sciencedevelopment.com, SciDev.com's article, in May, heavy rains brought on by Cyclone Ronu affected 340,000 persons and 22 of the island's 25 districts. Quoting Minister for Disaster Management, "These people have very limited coping mechanisms, and these kinds of disasters can drive them deeper into poverty." After the landslides and rains, the government decided to shift out those living in high-risk areas, but according to public officials, they are faced with the problems of locating safe land and making income from agriculture. And there's more on that article at SciDev.com. And I would like to comment this, of course. This sort of situation, of course, is going to lead to greater refugee numbers and a greater refugee crisis. The number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. From psmag.com, if you're a climate scientist, what happens when your dire predictions start coming true? The ongoing anthrax outbreak in Siberia is offering us a preview. What once was considered a future theoretical possibility, a reanimated deadly bacterium emerging from the permafrost, is now a reality. Throughout July, temperatures in northern Siberia have soared as high as 95 degrees Fahrenheit, 35 degrees Celsius during what is typically the warmest part of the year. And speaking for myself, this is, can you believe I'm talking about Siberia? 95 degrees in Siberia. It's unknown, they write, exactly how the disease emerged, possibly via a thawed reindeer carcass or human remains at a crumbling above-ground cemetery that's typical of the region. Once again, speaking for myself, above-ground cemetery because it used to be permanently frozen. Russia, they write, has sent troops trained for biological warfare to help establish a quarantine in what's become the first anthrax outbreak in the region since 1941. Skipping ahead, the temperatures are like New York City suddenly adopting the climate of Tucson for the whole month of July. To say the Arctic climate is off the charts this year is an understatement. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, and Sheila's on the air.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, Teresa, what I have to say is not very, very heartening. I was listening to Guy McPherson yesterday on Roland's program, And his predictions are terrible. He says, we are at the point, we're beyond the point of no return, first of all. And he predicts, or he doesn't really predict, but he's estimating that we have very little time in a livable world at this point. And he's not talking about little time as being in the big picture of 20, 50, 100, 500 years. He's talking about in the single digits, that the world, the Earth will become unsupportable to us within that short period of time. And that may be the reason why I hate to make excuses, but that may be the reason why the governments are doing so little, actually, to prevent climate change, because if it's beyond the point of no return, what's the point? And this is a very, sad scenario. He's saying, he wants to forget about these two four-letter words, fear and hope, because, fear is not going to do any good, and there is no hope, I guess, is what he means when he says that. So, it's really a sad state, but it looks like this is what's going to happen to us, and it's very unfortunate. So that's my miserable tale of woe, and we might as well get used to it. And this is the fact.
Don't quite exactly agree with that assessment, because we are currently geoengineering with jet contrails, and every night jet contrails go across the skies and hold the heat in. And we could ban that, and that would be immediate geoengineering that would immediately reverse the temperatures and dramatically.
Yeah, but the oceans can't be cured. The oceans are in terrible shape. The ice is melting. We're going to have water shortages. I mean, we can maybe stop or slow down certain things, but how much? And if you're not going to have water that you can drink, and the fish are not going to be able to live in the oceans, and the coral reefs are disintegrating, there's certain things that we can't change at this point. And, I wish you were correct, but I'm not so sure that you are.
Well, thank you for your opinion. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So that's it, unfortunately.
Okay, number to call, 503-231-8187. I'm always full of hope, and I think it's reflected by what I was referring to at the beginning of the show. If I think I'm about to die, I'll try to grab the gun. What have I got to lose? And I think that human-forced climate warming is, in fact, past the point of no return. I do think so, and I think drastic efforts are called for. Number to call, once again, 503-231-8187. Indiana is on the air.
Hi, good morning, Teresa. I'm glad to hear you're talking about this. And I also heard Guy McPherson speak twice on Paul Rowland's show, and then I went to hear him. And I would just like to add a couple of things. First, I'm glad that you're not calling it just climate change anymore, which is far too tame, and you are calling it...
Human-forced
You're calling it climate disaster, aren't you? Something like that?
Sure.
I've been using Paul Cienfuegos terminology, which I really appreciate, which is catastrophic climate destabilization. It's a mouthful, but it really says it. Anyway, the next thing I wanted to mention is that, yes, Guy McPherson did say those things, and he said that the reason he tells them is because he thinks it's important for us to know what he has found to be the case. He does not make predictions about when. He does say that. He says you can't. And he said the reason is that there are too many variables, feedback loops, that it's impossible to predict, but it's clear what's happening. And that's why I was really glad to hear what you're talking about this morning. Still, of course, here, right here where we live in Portland and in Oregon generally, things haven't gotten to the point where they have in Portugal and other places, but he's predicting this will happen. And his message that he wants to be clear about, and I am clear about this, I think, is that what we need to do with whatever the amount of time that remains to us is do what you really are passionate about, which you're doing, which I'm doing, and which you love to do, and let us focus on caring for the planet, each other, and that sort of thing. I mean, he's really predicting rather sooner than later human extinction, and he says the message is not to act like you've got your hair on fire or to be unrealistic about turning it around. At the same time, I do agree with you that there are things we can do to mitigate how fast this is happening, even though I don't know that, and you might. Thank you.
Well, thanks for calling in. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Glad to hear about the climate change broadcasts yesterday. I was busy putting together the book and record sale. By the way, if you enjoy vinyl, we are getting more stuff in and better stuff than we have for I don't know how many years. I don't know if I've ever seen this much, maybe close, in the 90s once when we filled the entire street out front. But we are going to have a book and record sale, and it's going and CDs and stuff like that. And that's going to be, let me see if I can remember properly, it's going to be at Cider Riot, which is over on Nathan Cooch, and it's really just a couple blocks from KBOO Studios. So if you can find Burnside Street in Portland, Oregon, you can find Cider Riot, and Cider Riot is going to be crammed to the gills with books and records. And as I was saying, if you're a collector, if you like that vinyl, oh boy, this is tasty. And there's so much we just can't deal with it. We're actually having to turn some stuff away at this point because it's too late. And somebody just offered us, I think, a couple dozen boxes. And we just, you know, where are we going to put it? So that's going to be big fun. That's Saturday, starting at noon at Cider Riot, the KBOO book and record sale. You're going to want to be there. Number to call, 503-231-8187, and Harry's on the air.
Greetings, Teresa. Thank you for taking my call. Last year, when you were driving your bus, you mentioned you caught them actually putting the contrails in the air.
I did, yes. I observed an event in which several jet aircraft flying in formation, not flying to the airport. I know where the airport travel ways are. And most people do if they pay attention around here. They did things like they traveled in formations. They were spraying something, not just contrails, although some of them simply were laying down contrails, which are quite effective in this regard. Some of them did an Immelmann turn, and I want to explain what this is. You don't do an Immelmann turn in a commercial aircraft. You do this in something like a fighter jet. This is something in which you turn the aircraft up so that it begins to ascend vertically, it flips itself over, and then you roll it so that you're going the opposite direction where you were going. This was used to create a cloud cap over Portland. I observed it very carefully and wrote about it at the time.
How high were these planes?
How high were they? They were contrail height. They had to be far higher than the approaching height of aircraft for the airport for them to be able to get away with it.
Huh, okay. Next thing is predictions. Next year is this year is supposed to be the last year of El Nino, and we're supposed to be switching over to El Nino, which is supposed to be a wetter and stronger storms. And of course, this is the western part of, you know, the Pacific or part of the United States, so this is going to affect us. Any predictions on what this is going to happen?
The last I had heard, El Nino had fizzled, and we still have you know, this warmest year. Let me just see what I can find on the web real quick. But there's still a blob, you know, the great blob, as they call it. Heated Pacific water is still happening.
That's in the middle of the Pacific, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's see. We have an article on thesnow.com talking about... let's see, it's about what is El Nino, and I'm not finding anything specific about what the effects of that phenomenon are right now. So I'm sorry, I'm not really able to answer the question.
Okay, okay. the next thing before I go is, we should look to the future, a more brighter future, and that is Alaska, our 50th state, is on the Arctic Ocean. Should we be purchasing beachfront property to make money?
Maybe you should be purchasing a property that's up a few feet from the beach. I don't know how that would work out. Things are changing, and I noticed in the climate change news aggregators that there is now talk of increasing sea level rise. Let's see. I was just looking at more information about El Nino, and they're talking about last year. It had there was a big El Nino last year. I'm not finding that 2016 is expected to be big in terms of El Nino. So I think that the answer is we're not expected to have a big El Nino this year.
Okay, good, good. Hey, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. Time is 9:39. You're listening to KBOO Portland Community Radio. And I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is called Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. The number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And to learn more about how the anthrax outbreak began, Robert Scribler wrote to, PS Mag wrote to Vladimir Romanovsky, climate scientist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He says a combination of erosion and melting of permafrost, which are related, may have helped mobilize sequestered anthrax into the local water supply. This combination of thawing, permafrost, and erosion is happening not just in Siberia, but Alaska and Canada as well. So we're talking about global warming, talking about anthrax outbreak. And I'm trying to frame it in this way, that we are now experiencing this climate disaster. And Robert is on, or Thomas is on the air.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, good morning. Teresa. Can you hear me?
I can, yes.
Yeah, I have a few thoughts that you can put it under the category of maybe of the possibility of, I don't want to say good news, but things that may mitigate some of the more dire consequences of this climate change. You know, my understanding is that the two major causes of mortality that would be associated with what's happening are famine and infectious disease. You know, at the end of the day, it's usually not waves going over the top of you and drowning you. It's those two things, good old famine and infectious disease. You know, obviously, famine directly linked to crop failure, and infectious disease is related most specifically to disease vectors emerging from changing climates and ecosystem and insects and other situations where that emerge in different areas where diseases can be spread more readily.
Sure, and you can add on the knock-on effects of those, for example, social unrest from the economic stress.
Right, they feed on each other, and of course, you know, in the quest for food, and in reaction to infectious disease, you get everything else. But as far as famine, here's a piece of good news potentially, and that is that, you know, animal agriculture really is the absolute wasteful, massively wasteful middleman, and that takes a lot of the energy right out of the equation as far as the benefit of food for the human being. In other words, in a time when we have less and less land available, agriculturally viable, it really doesn't make sense to have a situation, let's say, where beef cattle, where for every 100 food units of, be it soybean or corn or whatever you feed cattle, you get about one food unit out in the form of meat for humans. So essentially, you know, just in one thing alone, just eliminating the beef cattle, you get approximately a 100-to-1 multiplier effect. So in other words, rather than feeding the animal the food, you feed the food directly to people, and so you get this huge multiplier. And the only thing that makes sense, and surprise, surprise, if you look at animal agriculture, it not only is hugely wasteful of the food energy, the crops, but it also is one of the major contributors of greenhouse gases. So you get sort of a twofer.
I've encountered that information before, and it's interesting. What would you suggest? How would you suggest that information be acted on? What should be done?
Well, see, the problem is that, you know, the way we're headed now, it's going to end up being just like the Irish potato famine, where really the people in Ireland that died from the famous famine, it wasn't so much the fact that there wasn't anything that could be done. It was that the British insisted on the absolute last moment that potatoes be exported and that they stick to this cash, you know, used as a cash crop instead of feeding people. And I think exactly the same thing is going to happen with this monoculture corporate agriculture where most of the soybean and corn is being essentially put into animal feedstocks, I think that the people, unfortunately, in the so-called quote-unquote developing or let's say underdeveloped world, and other people who are most vulnerable are just going to die because the market's not going to change. So I think it, you know, unfortunately, it's likely that a lot of people are going to die before it inevitably, absolutely will have to change. And the good news is there are crops. There are plenty of crops that use much less water and are much higher protein yielding. And you combine that with feeding them directly to people. So, you know, we can feed ourselves. And then the second thing real quick is like the green presidential candidate Jill Stein suggested vaccine production, as far as the infectious disease end of it, it's absolutely absurd, the situation we have now where most vaccine production is done by the private sector. And the private sector really has very little incentive to manufacture research vaccines because they're not really very high profit level. And I say that as far as all the caveats associated with a lot of the bad vaccines notwithstanding. But as far as, you know, why shouldn't this vaccine production as a classic example of something that should be researched and funded vigorously by the governments for people? And that would go a long way towards helping mitigate some of the effects of infectious disease. So there again, I think those two things, if acted upon, are not answers to polluting the environment with CO2. We have to stop doing that. But at least we could immediately mitigate some of the most horrible human consequences of this climate change while we transition, hopefully.
Well, thank you for that opinion.
Thank you.
Interesting call. And the number to call, 503-231-8187. I would like to comment that, by the way, if we bring up vaccines and Jill Stein, no, she's not anti-vaccine. That's just a smear. And I'll be more blatant. It's a smear that comes from the Clinton campaign. She is pro-vaccine. How do I know she says so? And that's the end of it, really. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And Elliot is on the air.
Yes, I may say something that most of your listeners would not agree with, but people like this end-of-the-world environmentalist McPherson who was on this week, they're really articulating the predominant, even pervasive, meme on the left, which I would characterize by the sentence, "We have to save these conservative climate-denying boobs from their own destruction." And it's our moral duty on the left to do that. And it is based on a McPherson idea that we've passed a point of no return and there's no way to wait for the majority of the population to get good and scared and change their attitudes. But that's an empirical issue. We had a movement in this country to try to get us into World War II to stop the Nazis. And until Pearl Harbor, it didn't quite gel. And then Pearl Harbor happened, and we massively mobilized capital and labor, solved the problem. Now, why does the left obsess with saving the quality of life of millions of conservative working class climate-denying boobs? Let them feel the consequences of their action, and I'll finish by going even stronger.
Well, the problem is we're all in the same pot, you know, boob or not.
Yeah, but it's an empirical, it's a scientific question and a difficult one as to whether the transition to a catastrophe, you know, would be long enough that once the boobs realized how bad things were, that we couldn't mobilize capital and labor to solve the problem. And in more extremely, I would say that the year that we should massively invest to go renewable is the year after the blood in the veins of the people on Earth responsible for 90% of the irrational, hateful terrorism in the world on a Saudi peninsula. When their blood boils in their veins because it's 160 degrees in the shade in the Saudi peninsula,
getting into speculation here. When I'm hot, I don't feel particularly violent. I just feel very, very tired. Hey, thanks for your call. Number to call is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. More from Robert Scribbler. 2 inch per hour rainfall amounts are usually enough to completely overwhelm most drainage infrastructure, overtop banks, and turn streets into rivers. Ellicott City saw nearly 6 inches of rainfall in 2 hours and 5 inches of rainfall in just one. Such events are typically seen as quite rare. 100-year events or more, and building codes often do not account for them. Managing so much water is a major engineering challenge and requires a great deal of investment. Spending so much money on flood defense systems for a storm that might happen in 100 years or 1,000 years can sometimes seem like a waste at the time. However, in a world warned by climate change, such floods are happening with greater frequency. More on that, you can find it at robertscribbler.com. And I believe Paul is on the air.
Hello, Teresa.
Hi.
Thanks for the call. Thanks for the show. Great show. So the powers that be that are, ordering the contrails or whatever, that are genetically engineering everything, including us, if not yet, soon, they have kids, they have grandkids, they have 7 generations. So, they're human. So don't you think there's, I got to wonder, and I wonder what you wonder, that there's something going on that somebody somewhere is trying to do what they can to save humankind. It seems like whenever somebody gets elected president, they immediately turn gray. So there's some big something that they tell them once they get into the office that the rest of us don't know.
Or it's just an ordinary and habitual effort to dye one's hair before taking office and let it go afterwards.
Yeah, like Abe Lincoln growing out his beard.
Yeah.
But what do you think? I mean, doesn't it make sense that, and they may only be trying to save their own 1%, which is a major problem, but doesn't it seem like it's just all this greedy action doesn't make sense because they have kids too.
Well, yes, I'd like to address that.
I'd like to hear what you have to say about it. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thanks for your call. The elites know that they will be affected last and least by such disasters, and in the ultimate call, first, I should posit just how rich the very, very rich are. They're richer than they've ever been. To have $1 billion is to be like a king, and not just a king, but a particularly rich one. And so for them and their families, they will go to the places that are affected last and least. They will fly to New Zealand. They will maybe eventually they'll set up some nice resort on the sands of Antarctica. Now, you might want to say there aren't sands on Antarctica, but just you wait. They'll be just fine, and they know it. There's a famous scene in Dr. Strangelove, the 1964 movie, in which Dr. Strangelove begins to expostulate about the mine shaft gap, and he says that he starts off the discussion by saying that it would be possible to create a nice, well-populated and teeming society deep into mine shafts to avoid nuclear war, which used to be our great threat and still is, actually. And this gets into a cheerful discussion because he's amongst the elites in what was then an imaginary war planning center. And they all have a good time talking about what sort of people and what sort of beautiful women they would like to have down deep in their mine shaft while they wait out the radioactive fallout and let the whole world die. That's the sort of attitude that you can expect from the elites. So for the elites, there's gold and magnesium underneath the ice of the Arctic. Wouldn't it be convenient if that ice went away? They can just get that gold and magnesium and they can continue to have their 150-foot yachts. No, they don't care. And I think it's up to us collectively to realize that we have greatly excessively fed elites. I don't know if you can completely eliminate the human capacity, the human tendency to allow hierarchies and elitism, but you can certainly address it and be aware of it. And what we're doing right now is so wildly extreme that we're suffering the consequences of it. Half of the population of the United States is under dire economic stress and could be kicked out on the streets any day, and are being kicked out on the streets every day. And you know, many of our fellow workers who were paying $600 rent just last month are now living on the Springwater Corridor, and they're still getting their $600. They'd like to give it to someone for rent, but they have to live in a tent amid the meth heads and the squalor and the fear and the cops coming. It's terrifying, and it's meant to be. It's meant to be terrifying because the elites benefit from this. The poorer you are, the more your efforts create wealth that is driven into the super rich coffers. One requires the other. You can't have a Brazil without billionaires. And you can't have the United States in 2016 without billionaires. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And Randy's on the air talking about climate change. Hi, Randy.
Yes. I think as far as addressing this, one of my higher priorities I would like to see, the climate models are not really good enough to be truly predictive of any particular policy action if you look closely. Okay, there, I mean, there's just enough variation in them that it's disturbing, and we really need to get to the point that there is an absolute consensus on an improved models, and that's going to take some work and some funding to get.
Are you saying that global warming is an unsure thing?
No, I'm saying that the exact degree of variation that you would expect from specific policies, that there's variation within that if you look at the models carefully.
Okay, and when you say policies, you mean policies to address climate change?
Yeah, policies to address climate change. Like if you reduce CO2 emission by this much, what is going to happen? And we're really not at that point yet, and that's something that needs to be addressed, and it needs to be a thing that people that are active in this area need to be asking for. It's a fairly low-cost thing in the big scheme of things to ask for, but it basically, right now, we are literally flying blind. If you look at our predictive accuracy, there's a consensus that it's human-made, that it's real, but when you get to the saying, okay, what, how long do we have? That is not a point that I would say that there is a scientific consensus.
You're right, and for me, it's like we're at the point where we're like the denizens of the yellow submarine. We're in trouble. What will we do? Press a button.
That's kind of where it's at. Now, the other thing that I wrote about in 1992 in an article in the Oregon Peace Worker, I advocated a shift from the existing tax system to environmental taxes, specifically starting with the most regressive taxes we have, because environmental taxes by their nature tend to be regressive. Now, the way that you can prevent that from being an issue as you do the shift is you pair environmental taxes with taxes that are more progressive inherently. The most progressive tax you can have is a asset tax on concentrations of assets. It would be like, say, 5.4% per year for the top 0.1%. And you can, at the very least, make sure that the tax shift is neutral in terms of distribution if you do that carefully.
Well, you're talking my game. I'm an anarcho-socialist. I say confiscate the trillion-dollar offshore assets now. But thanks for your call.
I'll put it this way. I'm not going to say confiscation. I'm not going to say expropriation. But when you have a group that's growing at 5.4% after inflation and the median investor is growing at 0% after inflation, there's a lot of room for getting revenue, and I think you actually shoot yourself in the foot by talking about confiscation or expropriation.
Oh, I don't know. I'm a polemicist, and so I like to put the idea out there. I like to set the fire, but thank you very much for your call, and I'm almost out of time.
Okay.
Thanks for calling in. And you've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Have been talking about climate change and what to do about it, and the point that I've been trying to make is that we have reached the point now, today, in which the disaster is ongoing. It's showing up in terms of anthrax outbreaks, monsoon rains where there shouldn't be monsoon rains, extreme heat events, which are killers. And we haven't had that here, but I would just like to point out that a couple of weeks of over 100 degree temperatures over our forests would create some pretty disastrous fires. We're not, so to speak, out of the woods. So, yeah. It's up to you, and we're going to have to address this. And I thank you for listening to Press Watch. Stay tuned for more of the incomparable Radio Zine here on KBOO Portland. And we're going out to you via the big transmitter on the hill, 90.7 FM, and other translator transmitters that we have elsewhere in Cascadia, and via KBOO.FM, where you can find a lot of audio and useful things. That's where we expand into the interweb on KBOO.FM, and in that manner, we go out to all the ships at sea.
Hey, good morning. 1 minute now before 10 o'clock. It is KBOO, KBOO Portland, your community radio station. We're about an hour away from Between the Covers. We'll be speaking with Portland writer Robert Hill about his new novel, The Remnants, set in the isolated farm town of New Eden, which has arrived at its last days. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures. We'll be joining Oregon Historical Society director Carrie Timchuk for an audio preview of the Comic City USA exhibition, which spotlights comics arts creators from the Pacific Northwest, including the writer-artist duo Paul Gwinnan and Anina Bennett, who will also be in the studio for the show. That is all coming up this morning. Flashpoints in about 15 minutes, but we do have Chris Andre up next with Air Cascadia. It's headlines, interviews, and commentary right after this.
Come over here, to the right-hand speaker.
KBOO's book and record sale is happening August 13th at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Coot Street, starting at noon. Find treasures amongst the stacks of donated items while raising money for KBOO, your very own community radio station.
Friction between the stylus and the record produces a force which makes the arm try to swing towards the record center.
Again, that's KBOO's book and record sale, Saturday, August 13th from noon to 7 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Coot Street in Portland. More information can be found at KBOO.FM on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm now standing in the center, and my voice should be located precisely midway between the speakers.